Jacob, we're underway. All set? All righty, there we go. All righty, a month ago, we were in chapter 46. Chapter 46 began the third major section of Jeremiah, the prophecies concerning the Gentile nations. Remember, early on, Jeremiah was told by God, your ministry will not be limited to the Jewish people. It will go out to the nations of the world, and here we see that it does. The first nation he prophesies about is Egypt. He begins with the defeat of Egypt at the Battle of Carchemish. It takes two chapters going through his prophecy against Egypt, and the prophecy extends into the Messianic Kingdom, and we learn that Egypt will exist in the Messianic Kingdom, but for the first 40 years of the kingdom, the nation will be scattered, and then it will be regathered for the remainder of the kingdom. So there's kind of a judgment upon Egypt. Then we moved into chapter 47 and the Philistines. We dealt with the Nebuchadnezzar coming in and decimating the Philistines, which happened. There was nothing for prophetic in the sense of the Messianic Kingdom in regard to that. Then we got to chapter 48, and we got to the prophecy regarding Moab, modern central Jordan. Let's see, where are we here? Now, chapter 47 through chapter 48:11, we are in the prophet's present time or the near future, right around the Babylonian invasion of Israel and the Middle East. So as we come to the prophecy against Moab, we see the key nations we're going to be looking at: Edom to the south of the Dead Sea, Moab, the southern end of the Dead Sea. To the north of Moab was territory that was occupied by the tribe of Reuben, the Jewish tribe of Reuben, and then to the north of them, the tribe of Ammon, country of Ammon. Now, at this time, the Moabites had moved north and had conquered the Reubenites and displaced them. And so when we talk about Moab, we're talking about that entire area. Both the purple area here and the yellow area here is referred to as Moab. And this map is a map of Jeremiah's day. And you can see Moab extending from the southern tip of the Dead Sea to the northern tip of the Dead Sea. It's a good way to identify Moab. It's there east of the Dead Sea. Now, the prophecy predicted that Nebuchadnezzar would come down the Amoris. He would come into Philistine territory. He would decimate the Philistines. That's the prophecy against the Philistines. And you can see the key Philistine city-states here. Gaza, the same city we hear about today in the Gaza Strip. Ashkelon to the north is now a Jewish city. Ashdod to the north of Ashkelon is a Jewish city today. And then inland, there are three border fortresses: Eglon, Gath, that's where Goliath came from, and Ekron. So Nebuchadnezzar came in, decimated the Philistines. After he was done, he then moved east, taking care of the Jewish border cities, fortified cities of Lachish and Azekah. Azekah is just a little north of Lachish there. You remember the prophecies dealing with the Lachish letters, the Lachish letters. And he took Jerusalem, and that was 586 B.C. Jerusalem fell. After taking care of Jerusalem, Nebuchadnezzar then continued to move east, and he moved into Moab. Let's see. And God warns the Moabites in verse 6. He says to them, flee, save yourselves, that you may be like a juniper in the wilderness. Now, not everybody believes me when I tell you that this juniper is still alive, but it is. There are green leaves on it, but it's a beautiful picture of what God was talking about. It's a picture of survival in the midst of devastation. Flee, so that you will survive in the midst of the Babylonian devastation. All right, so let's see. In 48:11, we were in the prophet's present time, but as we move into chapter 48, verse 12, through chapter 46, we enter a prophecy that has a long process of fulfillment. It starts in the prophet's near future with the Babylonian attack, But then it continues until its culmination at the second coming of Messiah in verse 46. So you'll see why I've diagrammed this out when we get to verse 46, why I've diagrammed it out this way. But it's quite an interesting prophecy. All right. All righty. That brings us now to page 496. And we're in the middle of the page. We're at verse 18, point 3 in the middle of the page, is the calamity on the cities of Moab. So is everybody there in the outline? And everybody there in your scriptures, okay? All righty. All righty, we begin with the declaration of calamity on the cities of Moab now. And the declaration begins with the call to Dibon in verse 18. It's the city of Dibon. And on the map here, here's Dibon. Nebuchadnezzar came south, and one of the major cities that he attacked is Dibon. All right, verse 18. I suppose I better get back to the right chapter here. Verse 18. Come down from your glory and sit on the parched ground, O daughter dwelling in Dibon, for the destroyer of Moab has come up against you. He has ruined your strongholds. And as you can see in your outline, point A, 1, 2, 3, and 4 are other mentions of Dibon. Notice point 2. You see that it was at one time a city of Reuben. At one time it was a Jewish city because the Reubenites occupied that territory. But now the Moabites have conquered it. Point B, Dibon is told to come down from her glory. That means she was a prominent city in Moab, so that glory is going to be taken from her. She's going to sit in thirst, the picture of absolute devastation, sitting on the ground, dying of thirst. And why? Because the destroyer has come on the bottom of the page. All righty. Page 497. Another call goes out. In verse 19, the call to Aroer. Verse 19. Stand by the road and keep watch, O inhabitant of Aroer. Ask him who flees and her who escapes and say, what has happened? What's going on? Okay, if you'll see on the map, you'll see that Aroer is to the south of Dibon. So as Nebuchadnezzar came down and conquered Dibon, where did the refugees flee? They fled to the south, to Aroer. And you see the other mentions of Aroer under point A. And the inhabitants of Aroer are to ask a question to these refugees. What is going on? And the refugees answer in verse 20. Here's what they say. Moab has been put to shame, for it has been shattered. Wail and cry out. Declare by the Arnon that Moab has been destroyed. So that's the answer. The answer of the fleeing refugees. We've been devastated. Now, why did they say declare it by the Arnon? Well, the Arnon is a reference to the Arnon River and the Arnon Gorge. And on the map, there you can see it. This is a major gorge, a major canyon in Moab, and the Arnon River flows down there into the Dead Sea. It's very obvious from the Israeli side of the Dead Sea. You can see the Arnon Gorge. You can spot the center of Moab very easily from the Israeli side. But you see how it's located? It's right between Dibon and Aroer. And so you see why the reference is to the Arnon Gorge. Key geographical figure in Moab. Okay. The cities that are going to be destroyed is described in point B, toward the bottom of the page, verses 21 through 24. And you see that it says, judgment has come upon the plain country. And if you look up on the map, what he's referring to is the tableland to the east of Moab. You have the steep ascent up from the Dead Sea along the western border of Moab. But once you get up that steep ascent, everything levels off into a large plain. And so this is the tableland that is being described. And a number of cities are mentioned in verses 21 through 24. We don't know where most of these cities are. Verse 21. Judgment has come upon the plain, upon Holon, Yazah, and against Mepha'at, against Dibon, Nebo, and Beth Diblathaim, against Kiriathaim, Beth Gamul, and Beth Me'on, against Kiriot, Basra, and all the cities of the land of Moab, far and near. So in your outline, you see the first five cities mentioned there, and you can see other cross-references to those cities. Turn the page to page 498. And on page 498, cities 6 through 11 are listed there for you and cross-references. Now note city number 11, Basra, also known as Bezer. Now this is not, and I repeat, this is not the Basra of the Edomites. Okay, it can be confusing. This is the Basra of the Moabites. Same name. Now that Basra of the Edomites is the city that impacts eschatology the most. That's going to be the initial point of the second coming. That's also known as Petra today. So Basra of the Edomites is a different city. Okay, this particular city has no eschatological importance. Okay, is that clear? Basra of the Moabites here. All right, so the conclusion, all these cities are going to be attacked and destroyed. And in verse 25, we come to the conclusion. Verse 25, the horn of Moab has been cut off, his arm broken, declares the Lord. Now, does that mean that some trumpeter got a spear in his chest? The horn of Moab? No. The horn of an animal. Here's a picture of an ibex. Cute little guy, isn't he? But you notice he has these very prominent horns, and the horns are on an animal with the source of his power and his authority. You know, if he's going to defend himself, he's going to use those horns, right? And so horns became to have a metaphorical use, and when they're used symbolically, as is here in verse 25, it speaks of the power and authority of the city, of God, of the country. There's horns on the altar and the temple, speaking of God's power and authority. So here the idea is that the power and authority of Moab has been destroyed. The other picture, his arm is broken. Again, the arm, a picture of strength. And so Moab is helpless. Her strength is removed. Her power is removed. Her authority is gone. The invasion has devastated the cities of the plain. Now why? Why did this happen to Moab? And when we turn to page 499, we come to the reason. God explains why he's bringing this punishment upon Moab. And the reason is for the pride of Moab. And this is Moab's first major problem. And it was an extreme problem, as you'll see in the next few minutes. So we're on page 499. We're picking it up at verse 26 as we look at Moab's pride. Verse 26. God says, make him drunk, for he has become arrogant toward the Lord. And so Moab will wallow in his vomit, and he also will become a laughingstock. Now, this is a very appropriate judgment for Moab for two reasons. First of all, point A, make him drunken. Well, one reason why he is he's described as being drunken is to drown out his coming sorrow. But the reason God chose this picture, this symbol, was because Moab was famous for wine. Moab was very famous for wine. And so you imbibe too much wine, what happens? You're drunk. Okay, so that's the picture. Moab is unable to defend herself, her power broken. And that's because she's drunk. Drunk with the wine, basically, of God's wrath here. So it's a very appropriate picture for Moab. So the reason why make him drunken? Because he magnifies himself against Jehovah, against the Lord. He has an overblown opinion of himself. And when we people, Jew or Gentile alike, when we have an overblown opinion of ourselves, that causes us to rebel against God, right? We don't think we need him. We think we know better than him. And you know, modern man doesn't like God's view of us. What's God's view of us? Well, our God's view of us is in Psalm 103. In Psalm 103, verse 14, he says, "He is mindful that we are but dust." Modern man doesn't like that, do we? We've been to the moon. I mean, we're orbiting the planet. We can look out into the solar system. We're something. We don't need God. It's interesting that modern man, in their rejection of God, where does modern man say we came from? Evolution, right? So they say we came from the dust, right? If modern man says evolution is our source, then we came from the dust. Well, we did come from the dust, but God created us. From dust we came, from dust we return, right? He knows what we're like. We are but dust. So we need to have a proper evaluation of ourselves. Okay? Now, even though we are but dust, when we become a child of God, we become a beloved piece of dust, don't we? Everyone in this room is a beloved dust bunny, right? And we read that in Psalm 103. And this is why Psalm 103 is so cool. Verses 12 through 14. "As far as the east is from the west, so far has he removed our transgressions from us. Just as a father has compassion on his children, so the Lord has compassion on those who fear him." Why does he have compassion on us? Why did he send his son, Yeshua, the Messiah, to remove our transgressions from us? "Because he himself knows our frame, he's mindful that we are but dust." Dust can't take care of sin, can we? Can we take care of sin? Little dust bunnies being blown around by this world? No. And so we have a loving Heavenly Father that's done that for us out of his deep compassion for us. And because he's compassionate toward us, the Brit Hadashah, the New Covenant, and the Hebrew Scriptures are full of verses that say we should be compassionate to our brothers and sisters. We're all in the same boat, aren't we? We're all in the same boat, every human being. And so whether they're a believer or not, we need to take God's view of human beings. And that'll get rid of our overblown opinion of ourselves, won't it? And it'll take care of any desire to rebel against God. It reminds me of that joke where the scientist said, "Oh, we don't need you, God. We can make life all on our own." So God said, "Okay, well, let's make a man." So the scientist reaches down and grabs a scoop of dirt, and God says, "Get your own dirt. Get your own dirt." Yeah, we need him, and in our pride, we think we don't. Think we don't. All righty. We are but dust, and we need to remember that. And that's why he is compassionate. But Moab didn't remember that. In verse 26, Moab magnified himself against the Lord. And the results, point C, and it's a disgusting picture, isn't it? He will wallow in his vomit and he will be in derision. The picture here is this guy, he's a drunk on too much wine, too much of the good stuff, Moabitish wine, even better than the French stuff probably, huh? And he's totally out of his mind with the drunkenness and lying there, and people are standing around him laughing at him. So much for the pride of Moab. So much for the pride of Moab. That's what God is doing to him. That's the picture. All right, so that's Moab's first problem, pride. Moab's second problem, point two, is her anti-Semitism. This is her second major problem. And by the way, the Moabites were half-brothers to the Jews. But Anti-Semitism goes across all lines. All right, verse 27. God says, "Now was not Israel a laughingstock to you? Or was he caught among thieves? For each time you speak about him, you shake your head in scorn." All right, point A there. The Old American Standard says, "Was not Israel a derision unto you?" Was not Israel considered someone just to poke fun at and to mock and to scorn? That was Moab's view of her Jewish half-brothers. And you know, anti-Semitism is very much alive and well. We have some other half-brothers that have fallen into the same trap. Unfortunately, there are Arab half-brothers. And here's an example of modern anti-Semitism and mockery. This came out in the Muslim Observer. I'm not familiar with that newspaper, but I don't really know if I want to be. But they had this up on the internet. And look at the mockery here. They're mocking Ariel Sharon when he was the Prime Minister of Israel. And they're mocking the Holocaust. They're Holocaust deniers. And you see, Ariel Sharon is saying, "If anti-Semitism didn't exist, we'd have to invent it." And of course, what do you see behind him? "Oh, anti-Semitism was invented by the Jews. It doesn't really exist. The Holocaust doesn't really exist. It's being manufactured in Israel. Holocaust are us. Proudly manufacturing anti-Semitism since 1948. See the mockery there? It never happened, you guys. Well, I hope all of you get a chance to go to Yad Vashem someday. Anyway, it's still there. Anti-Semitism is still there. Moab had it back in Jeremiah's day. Then God asks a rhetorical question. Was he found among thieves? And the idea here, you can see in your notes, was Israel caught in the act of stealing? Did she commit a crime against you that you mock her and scorn her? Is that why you hate her? And of course the answer is no. And the picture there is, often as you speak of him, you wag your head in contempt. So even in their daily conversations, the Moabites mocked and scorned their Jewish brothers on the other side of the Jordan Valley. So they had a consistent and unrelenting contempt for the Jewish people. So two problems, pride and anti-Semitism. But God in his mercy issues a warning to the cities of Moab. In light of your pride and your anti-Semitism, you will be judged, but here's a warning. Verse 28. "Leave the cities, and dwell among the crags, O inhabitants of Moab, and be like a dove that nests beyond the mouth of the chasm." Okay, there's that merciful warning. You're about to be devastated. We'll learn why God issues warnings all the time. It's an aspect of his compassion. So he issues a warning to the Moabites. As we move to page 500, boy, that's a milestone. How many have been here for 500 pages? Good for you. Anyone, you ought to get an award. 500 pages. Okay. In verse 29, the pride of Moab is again described. Verse 29. "We have heard of the pride of Moab. He is very proud of his haughtiness, his pride, his arrogance, and his self-exaltation." Now here, God needs six expressions to fully and adequately describe the pride of Moab. So you have the topic introduced with point A. She has pride, and then there's other mentions, Isaiah and Zephaniah. They were famous for their pride. It'd be interesting to meet a Moabite. I guess you'd know him right off by his proud, haughty demeanor and his anti-Semitic mockery. Okay, so he's proud. Now, point B, this pride is described as very proud. The Hebrew there means extreme self-confidence. Extreme self-confidence. Very proud. Point C, the pride is further described as lofty, loftiness. This word in Hebrew means to be lifted up. It means self-admiration. And you begin to see a pattern here, a pattern to pride. You begin with self-confidence, "I can do anything," and then you begin to admire yourself. You look at the mirror, mirror, mirror on the wall. Who's the most beautiful Moabite of all? Okay. Okay, then the next point, the word pride there means to be exalted. Point D means to be exalted. So here's self-exaltation. You have self-confidence, self-admiration, and so when you're admiring yourself in the mirror, you exalt yourself. Ooh, am I cool? I am the best. Then point E, you move to arrogance. The word there means self-importance. Self-importance. I am the best and therefore I am significant. More significant than anyone else. Self-confidence, self-admiration, self-exaltation, self-importance. And finally, the last word describing Moabite, the Moabite pride, is haughtiness. The Hebrew word here means height. It means to have a high heart. It means to act presumptuously. Act presumptuously. See the pattern? Once you feel self-important, you do whatever you want. The law doesn't apply to me. You know, common sense doesn't apply to me. I am in charge. I can do anything I want. So you see where their pride had gone? So what are the results of this kind of extreme, overwhelming pride? Verse 30. I know his fury, declares the Lord, but it is futile. His idle boasts have accomplished nothing. So what's Moab in God's sight? Dust. And God will prove it. God will prove it in a short time. All right, he's going to prove it by punishing Moab on page 501. So we now move to the punishment that's coming upon Moab. And here we get a little peek into the heart of God. Here we learn why he always extends a warning, or I should say usually extends a warning. No matter who he's going to judge, usually a warning precedes this. Why? Well, we begin in the first part of verse 31 with a lamentation. Now, who is speaking in verse 30? God was. So who's lamenting in verse 31? Probably God. In the context, it is the Lord. Okay, verse 31. Therefore, I shall wail for Moab, even for all Moab shall I cry out. So this gives us that peek into the compassion of God's heart. He is not happy with judgment. Judgment grieves him. He's a person. He's not a force. He's not gravity. He's not radiation. You know, if a child falls off a balcony three stories up and falls to the ground and gets killed, gravity doesn't care. It's just the force, you know. But when judgment falls from God, it comes from a person and he grieves. He much prefers to exhibit compassion rather than wrath and anger. He does exhibit wrath and anger. There's no doubt about it, because his holiness has to be satisfied. But his love has to be satisfied too. And so he exhibits compassion. And a good other verses that substantiate these kind of thoughts, Ezekiel 18:23, good cross-reference. Ezekiel 18:23, do I have any pleasure in the death of the wicked, declares the Lord, rather that he should turn from his ways and live? The answer there is, of course, no. God takes no pleasure in judgment. Ezekiel 33:11, say to them, as I live. Now, this is a solemn declaration by his own eternal, everlasting nature. You can't swear by anyone higher than God, by his own unending life. As I live, declares the Lord God, and he will never die, I take no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but rather that the wicked turn from his way and live. And then the plea, turn back from your evil ways. Why then will you die, O house of Israel? Here he's going to bring judgment upon his own people. But you know, he brings that warning upon Gentiles too. It means anti-Semitic Gentiles. This is what angered Jonah so much, right? Remember? Jonah brought warning to Nineveh, and Nineveh did exactly what God wanted. They changed. They repented. Jonah was a little ticked off. He hadn't learned about this side of God's nature. Okay, so whenever judgment comes, whether it be the tribulation or whether it be upon Moab, it always comes through God's heavy heart. But it will come. He will not sweep judgment under the table because he's also holy. Always keep him in balance. Okay, so there we have a look into the heart of God, his great compassion. And now he's lamenting. He's lamenting for the cities of Moab in the second part of verse 31. He laments for a particular city, verse 31, second part of the verse. I will moan for the men of Kir Haris. And again, there's some cross-references there mentioning that city. It's modern Kerak in Jordan. We do know where that city is located. And then in verses 32 and 33, he mourns for the vine of Sibma. Verse 32 and 33. More than the weeping for Yazer, I shall weep for you, O vine of Sibma. Your tendrils stretched across the sea. They reach to the sea of Yazer. Upon your summer fruits and your grape harvest, the destroyer has fallen. And so gladness and joy are taken away from the fruitful field, even from the land of Moab. And I have made the wine to cease from the wine presses. No one will tread them with shouting. The shouting will not be shouts of joy. Now, why does he mourn for the wines of Sibma? That's because the wine that came from Sibma was Moab's highest quality wine. This was the best of the best. This was their prize product. In point two there, he says, your branches passed over the sun and reached the sea of Yazer. The reason he states that lies in the fact that the wine of Sibma was exported. You know, it was the good stuff. The good stuff always gets exported, right? Brings a lot of money in. The good oranges, the good apples, the good strawberries, they all go out of state, right? Same thing here. Okay? And so the picture here is a grapevine with its tendrils extending far and wide, moving out of Moab, crossing countries, going to other locations, because the wine went all over the Middle East. But the destroyer has come, point five at the bottom of the page. Moab's most cherished product is destroyed. The product that put Moab on the map is gone. It'd be kind of like Saudi Arabia losing their oil. Saudi Arabia is a one-product country. They lose their oil and they go back to poverty. Kind of like Saudi Arabia losing their oil fields. On page 502, again, the wine manufacturer has ceased at the top of the page. There's no shouting like the shouting for joy when you're crushing the grapes. When there's a plentiful harvest, the men crush the grapes with great joy. Sorry, that's gone. And this cry is not only over the wine of Sibma, or the vine of Sibma. This cry is heard all over the land in verse 34. Verse 34. From the outcry at Heshbon, even to Elalah, even to Yahaz, they have raised their voice. From Zoar, even to Horonaim, and to Eglat Shelishiya, for even the waters of Nimrim will become desolate. So now various cities are again mentioned. As we look on our map, these are different cities. Previously, he mentioned cities on the plain, but now he mentions cities on the slopes of the Jordan Valley. So the devastator is also going to come down in this area of Moab. The whole country will be destroyed. Everything, from the cities on the slopes to the cities on the plain, everything. And he names those cities. And so in verse 35, we come to the conclusion of the punishment. Verse 35, I shall make an end of Moab, declares the Lord. The one who offers sacrifice on the high place and the one who burns incense to his gods. And so not only is God going to destroy the economy of Moab and the cities of Moab, but he's also going to destroy the idol worship of Moab. And you know, that was the issue in the ancient Near East. If one country conquered another, it was thought that my God is stronger than your God. You know, we beat you up. My God beat up your God. And so if Moab had taken over Reuben, they'd be saying, well, my God is stronger than your God. And so that's why God is going to show that idol worship is useless, powerless, a lie. Page 503. Lamentation continues with a dirge. Now, a dirge is a funeral song. A dirge is not a party song, it's a funeral song, a song of lamentation. And so the appropriate instruments are brought out, the funeral pipes in verse 36. Therefore my heart wails for Moab like flutes. My heart also wails like flutes for the men of Kir-Hareth. Therefore they have lost the abundance it produced. So you see the NASB, the old ASB translates flutes there as funeral pipes. These were mournful sounding instruments. So God continues to mourn over the judgment that he's going to bring upon Moab. And God's not the only one who's mourning. The Moabites are mourning as well in verse 37. For every head is bald and every beard cut short. There are gashes in all the hands and sackcloth on the loins. And so all these are signs of mourning in the first century. Shaving the head, cutting back your beard, gashing your flesh, and wearing crude, uncomfortable, coarse cloth, a sackcloth. All signs of mourning. And you know, if a Moabite came into modern America and saw all of us with short hair and no beards, he'd walk around saying, "Why is everybody mourning around here?" Then he'd see these guys with their heads shaved. Man, everybody's in mourning here. You know? Totally different view of hair and beards. Okay. And why is everybody mourning? Because Moab is a broken vessel. The lamentation continues, first part of verse 38. On all the housetops of Moab and in all its streets, there is lamentation everywhere. Why? Last part of verse 38. For I, that's God, for I have broken Moab like an undesirable vessel, declares the Lord. The picture here is an earthen vessel thrown to the ground, broken into 1,000 potsherds. So, you drop a vessel, you break the corner off, oh, it's useless now. Just take it to the dump and throw it to the ground. That's the picture of Moab. And so the results of the judgment are described in verse 39, page 504. Page 504, verse 39. How shattered it is. How they have wailed. How Moab has turned his back. He is ashamed. And so Moab will become a laughing stock, an object of terror to all around them. And you notice how the punishment fits the crime? Moab's major problem was overwhelming pride. And again, Moab has now shamed, mocked. She's in derision. So she thought so highly of herself. She thinks of herself that way no longer. Now we move to point 6, and we come to the fact that the doom of Moab is inescapable. This is the final aspect of this judgment. It cannot be turned away. It begins with the figure of an eagle, and I put that up on the screen here. I thought it was quite an amazing picture. Jeremiah 48:40. Next verse. For thus says the Lord, behold, one will fly swiftly like an eagle and spread out his wings against Moab. You don't want to be in the receiving end of that guy, do you? You don't want to be a little mouse, you know, a Moab the mouse. Okay, that's the picture there. The enemy swooping down like this eagle. And when he does, the mighty men of Moab are devastated with fear. Verse 41. Kerioth has been captured, and the strongholds have been seized. So the hearts of the mighty men of Moab in that day will be like the heart of a woman in labor. And so these mighty soldiers are reduced to screams of agony. Even the easiest birth is pretty tough, isn't it, ladies? I don't know. I haven't been through it. I have watched it, though. I don't want to be there. I don't enjoy being a girl. I enjoy being a guy, you know. All right. So these mighty men reduced to screams of agony. You ladies can identify with that statement more than we can. And so the totality of the judgment in verse 42, Moab will be destroyed from being a people because he has become arrogant toward the Lord. There's the reason. Israel is not their enemy. The Lord is their enemy. And so the inescapability of the destruction, again brought out in page 505, verse 43. Three figures describe the destruction in verse 43. Terror, pit, and snare are coming upon you, O inhabitant of Moab, declares the Lord. And point A, the Hebrew there has a lot of assonance. The words sound the same, if you know the Hebrew. And verse 44a brings out the point that it's an inescapable judgment. Verse 44, the one who flees from the terror will fall into a pit. And the one who climbs out of the pit will be caught in the snare. So no matter what you do, you're in trouble. You run from the enemy and you run right into a pit. Most of you are devastated by your fall into the pit, but a few of you can scramble out of the pit, and guess what? You fall into a trap. So no matter what you do, Moab, you're going to be judged. And the ultimate cause is God, verse 44, second part of the verse, I shall bring upon her, even upon Moab, the year of their punishment, says the Lord. Now, in verse 45, we come to a fascinating verse that really brings in a new element to this prophecy, the results of the destruction, first of all, upon the escapees in verse 45. In the shadow of Heshbon, the fugitives stand without strength. For a fire has gone forth from Heshbon, and a flame from the midst of Sihon. And it has devoured the forehead of Moab and the scalps of the riotous revelers. Now this reference to the forehead of Moab being devoured should key our minds to a very important messianic prophecy. Point parentheses E there. Numbers 24:17. Here's Numbers 24:17. This is a messianic prophecy issued by Balaam in the Balaam oracles. Balaam says, I see him, the Messiah, but not now, not immediately, in the far distant future. I behold him, but not near. So he's looking far into the distant future to the coming of the Messiah. He describes the Messiah as a star shall come forth from Jacob. He'll be Jewish. A scepter shall arise from Israel, a king. A mighty king is going to come out of Judah, out of Israel. And what will this mighty king do? He shall crush through the forehead of Moab and tear down the sons of Sheth. And so this clues us into the fact that this judgment of Moab finds its conclusion in the tribulation period with the second coming. With the second coming. And that's why I've diagrammed it this way. The destruction of Moab begins in Jeremiah's day, in Babylon's day, and it continues to be culminated in verse 46 with the second coming. And we'll see that in just a moment here. Oops, I've got 8 o'clock. All right, stick with me for one more page, okay? Verse 46, the captivity of Moab. Then we'll take our break. It might be a little shorter break than normal. Sorry about that. Woe to you, Moab! The people of Chemosh have perished, and your sons have been taken away captive, your daughters into captivity. Unfortunately, there's a number of letters missing there. That's a copier demon. I don't know why. If you look at the original, all the letters are there. So if you can fill it in, that would help out. But the fulfillment. Point F, the point of it is the fulfillment is a long process. Notice point F1. Moab is taken into captivity by Babylon. This began the process of the nation of Moab being judged, and the nation of Moab actually disappeared there with the captivity by Babylon. That happened around 586 BC, right around that time frame. Then we move 586 years into the first century, And in the first century, Moab was heavily settled by the Nabataeans. That's an N for the Nabataeans there, heavily settled by Nabataeans. An H and an N are missing there. Now, the Nabataeans were Arab tribes that moved into that area. They came out of the Arabian Peninsula and settled in the area of Moab. Then point three, I is missing. In the Byzantine period, B is missing. The area was settled by Arabs still. And the Byzantine period lasted from the 3rd to the 15th century. And the area is still settled by Arabs. It's called Jordan today. The country of Moab does not exist today. And so for Balaam, point four there, for Balaam's prophecy to see its complete fulfillment, we have to look forward to the tribulation and the second coming. And we see in verse 47 that there will be a restoration of Moab. And here, our time frame moves into the kingdom period, verse 47. There'll be a restoration of Moab, verse 47. Yet I will restore the fortunes of Moab in the latter days, declares the Lord. Thus far, the judgment of Moab. And so in the kingdom period, there will be a saved nation called Moab in the Messianic kingdom. So even though they've been decimated for thousands of years, God's mercy is still being extended to the Moabites. There will be a country of Moab in the kingdom. All righty. I've taken you 3 minutes over into your break. So go ahead and take your break, and we'll pick it up in 12 minutes, okay? I got a lot to cover. I'm a little bit behind. All right, thanks, Jacob. All right, we're moving into page 507 and chapter 49. You see some rabbinic comments about Moab on the top of the page. You can read those at your leisure. Chapter 49 moves us to focus on a new country, the country of Ammon, in the first six verses. So we, in our time frame up here, chapter 49, we move from the kingdom in verse 47 to chapter 49, verse 1. We jump into the Jeremiah's near future again with the Babylonian invasion of Ammon, or Jeremiah's time. And so the new topic is described in the first part of verse 1 concerning the sons of Ammon. Very clear. And then we have additional prophecies regarding that country, points A, B, C, and D. Now I've left the one of the doors open at the back and at the front. If it gets too noisy, let me know. The complaint last time I did that was it got too cold. But anyway, the noise didn't seem to bother people, just the temperature. But I'm feeling pretty good right now. So let us know if it's too noisy or too cold. We'll close the door. All right, Ammon will be judged. And what is Ammon's sin? Second part of verse 1, the sin is the possession of Jewish territory. Second part of verse 1, thus says the Lord, does Israel have no sons, or has he no heirs? Why then has Malcham take possession of Gad, and his people settled in its cities? So he asks two rhetorical questions. Has Israel no sons? And the answer is, of course Israel has sons. Has Israel no heir? Well, Israel does have an heir. Now, if Israel had no sons and no heir, it would be okay for the Ammonites to occupy this territory because there would be no owners to that territory. They'd be non-existent. The problem here is that there are proper owners to that territory. Israel has the title deed to the Promised Land, and Ammon is possessing territory belonging to the Jewish people. Point C, he says, why does Malcham possess Gad? Malcham is a reference to Moloch, who is the king, the national god of the Ammonites. Point A and B there. So the idea is, again, my god's tougher than your god. The Ammonites have taken over the territory, so Malcham is greater than Israel's god. And Israel's God is not going to be treated in that manner. All right, page 508. Now, a map shows us what happened here. Again, here's that map I showed you before. And this is the territory that had been allotted to Gad, the tribe of Gad. And this is where the Ammonites lived. But the Ammonites had advanced to the west and had taken over the territory of Gad, and so that whole area was known as Ammon at this time. That was the problem. They had taken over Jewish territory. And so the punishment is outlined in verse 2, chapter 49, verse 2. Therefore, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, that I shall cause a trumpet blast of war to be heard against Rabbah of the sons of Ammon, and it will become a desolate heap, and her towns will be set on fire, and then Israel shall take possession of his possessors. Well, the first hint that we have a important prophecy comes in the statement, the days to come. Point A1 there, this puts us in the prophetic future. So all of a sudden, from Jeremiah's day in verse 1, we jump into the tribulation period in verses 2 through 5. We're going to be looking at the tribulation period here. So that's point A. Point B, middle of the page there, he says there's going to be war against Rabbah of the children of Ammon. You see the Hebrew there, but point 2 brings out the fact that this is a reference to modern Amman, Jordan. The same city. Rabbah and Amman are the same city. So this modern city in Jordan is under divine judgment. Now here's a map. Here's a map of modern Jordan. The area where I put the red circle is the area of Ammon. That's the ancient territory of Ammon. Now let's focus in on that territory. South of the Dead Sea is Edom. The width of the Dead Sea is where the Moabites lived. And just to the north of Moab is Amman, Jordan. There's the modern capital of Jordan. Okay, that's the city we're talking about. That's Rabbah. That's Amman. That city is under divine judgment at the moment. Now, what's going to happen to that city? Point C on your outline. It shall become a desolate heap. The word there is a tell. It will become a tell. Anyone remember what a tell is? It's a city mound, right? City mound, destroyed cities, one on top of each other, until a mound raises up. It's a city mound. Well, is Amman, Jordan a tell these days? There's modern Amman. It's a modern, bustling city. You know how modern it is? Look at this. There it is. McDonald's in Arabic. What else do you see? All right, you see Burger King in English. What else do you see? Keep looking. There it is. Kentucky Fried Chicken. This is not a tell. This is a modern bustling city, okay? But the prophecy is that someday this area will be a ruin. It will be a tell. And so that tells us that this prophecy has not yet seen its fulfillment. It will see its fulfillment in the tribulation period when point D, her daughters are burned with fire. In other words, the suburbs of Ammon are destroyed. And what happens when Ammon, Jordan is destroyed? Point D, then shall Israel possess them that did possess her. In other words, Israel is going to possess this territory in the kingdom. Israel will possess this territory. We do not possess this territory today, but we will in the kingdom. And the rabbis have some comments there that you can read. They basically agree with that assessment. All right, page 509. Page 509. Description of this judgment to come upon Ammon and Amman in particular. Verse 3, chapter 49, verse 3. Wail, O Heshbon, for Ai has been destroyed. Cry out, O daughters of Rabbah. Gird yourselves with sackcloth and lament, and rush back and forth inside the walls. For Malcham will go into exile, together with his priests and his princes. And so two major cities are mentioned, Heshbon and Ai, and then Rabbah, the daughters of Rabbah, the capital city of Rabbah is mentioned. And the reason why you should lament over these cities, point four, point B4, Malcham will go into captivity. There's the god of the Ammonites again. He will go into captivity. This idea that my God is greater than your God will be thrown to the ground as God destroys the idols. And notice the note as Chemosh in Jeremiah 48:7. Chemosh was the god of Moab. So the idolatry of Moab and the idolatry of Ammon will be gone. And that will bring a cessation of the boasting of the Ammonites in verse 4. Verse 4. How boastful you are about the valleys. Your valley is flowing away. O backsliding daughter who treats her treasures, who trusts in her treasures, saying, who will come against me? Well, the treasures of the Ammonites were her fruitful, fertile valleys, point B. Point A and B. You glory in your valleys. You trust in your treasures. The valleys were fruitful, productive. And not only that, point C, she was confident she would not be invaded. Who's going to come onto me? I'm safe. So she boasted and trusted in these blessings that God had given her. But she didn't boast in the Lord. And so the reason in verse 5 for the lamentation comes about. Here's the reason for the lamentation. Verse 5, behold, I am going to bring terror upon you, declares the Lord God of hosts, from all directions around you. And each of you will be driven out headlong, with no one to gather the fugitives together. And so the territory of Ammon is destined for dispersion. God is going to drive out the Ammonites, the people living in that territory, totally drive them out. However, as we move to page 510, again, God's mercy becomes apparent. Because as we get to verse 6, we come to the restoration of Ammon in verse 6. She will be destroyed and dispersed, but then she will be restored. Verse 6. But afterward, I will restore the fortunes of the sons of Ammon, declares the Lord. So this moves us forward into the kingdom period. In verse 5, we were in the tribulation period with the destruction of the city of Ammon, Jordan. But now, in verse 6, we move into the kingdom for the restoration of this territory. Now, we don't know exactly what the boundaries of this territory are going to be, but there will be a saved nation called Ammon in the Messianic kingdom. In that area, there will be a nation again. Just as with Egypt, point B there, just as with Moab, so there will be an Ammon in the kingdom, in the Messianic kingdom. So again, God's mercy is very apparent even to those who today turn their back on Him. All right. Now, moving on to verse 7, point F on your outline, we come to a very, very important country, probably the most important country to date, the country of Edom. God will have a lot to say about Edom. And in fact, we're going to even have to review the campaign of Armageddon to bring you up to speed on the importance of Edom. So the topic begins in verse 7. New topic, concerning Edom. Now remember, in the ancient Hebrew text, you didn't have a little bold note there that says prophecies against Edom or something like that. All the words just flowed together. So you needed an indicator where a new topic began. And so that's why verse 7 says, concerning Edom. This is a new topic. Now, where is Edom? Here's that map again, and Edom is here to the south of Moab. That's the country of Edom. Here's your modern map of Jordan again. In northern Jordan, we have the ancient territory of Ammon. In central Jordan, we have the ancient territory of Moab. So Ammon, north of the Dead Sea. Remember, it's very easy to remember, north of the Dead Sea. Moab, from the northern tip to the southern tip of the Dead Sea. And then Edom, south of the Dead Sea, all on the eastern side of the Jordan Valley. Okay? So there's the territory that we're talking about superimposed over a modern map. There will be no country of Jordan in the kingdom. Those lines drawn by the British are going to be erased by the Lord. Okay? All right, so there's a lot to say about Edom. God has a lot to say about Edom in Scripture. You see 7 cross-references at the bottom of page 510. All right, page 511, again, some more rabbinic comments you can read on your own. The second part of verse 7 asks the question about Edomite wisdom. Verse 7, second part of the verse. Thus says the Lord of hosts, is there no longer any wisdom in Teman? Has good counsel been lost to the prudent? Has their wisdom decayed? Now, this reference to Teman is a reference to a city. Teman was, as you see point A there, Teman was the grandson of Esau, and he established a city in his own name. So this is basically a reference to the city of Teman. And the men of Edom and the men of Teman were noted for their wisdom. But God asked the question, has their counsel perished? Has their wisdom vanished? And the answer is yes. And we need to know why. Why is their wisdom gone? The answer to that comes on page 512 with verse 8. Calamity. Calamity has come upon Esau. Esau was the progenitor of the Edomites. So Esau is his name. He was a progenitor of the people that lived in the region called Edom, the Edomites. So let's take a look at verse 8. Flee away, turn back, dwell in the depths, O inhabitants of Dedan. For I will bring disaster, the disaster of Esau upon him at the time that I punish him. Now, a warning is given to Dedan. Dedan is an Arabic tribe. They're a Bedouin tribe that lived in the Arabian Peninsula. Here is the area of Edom on the map. And you see, here's the Arabian Peninsula right here. So the Dedanites, this tribe, wandered throughout this area that we call Saudi Arabia today. So they were just south and east of Edom. So they're warned to flee into the depth. And the idea there is the depth of the Arabian desert. Flee deep into the Arabian desert. Why? Why should they flee? Because, point two, calamity is coming upon Esau. In other words, the judgment that I bring upon Edom, the judgment I bring upon Esau will spill over onto them. So get out of the way. Get to a safe space. Get deep in the desert. So Dedan is warned. Now the totality of the calamity coming upon Esau, coming upon Edom, is emphasized in verses 9 and 10. And he describes this destruction under two pictures, two figures. Figure of grapes and the figure of thieves. So here's a picture of the grapes. Now they look pretty good, right? Yeah, those are nice. Let's see what he says here. Verse 9. If grape gatherers came to you, would they not leave gleanings? If thieves came by night, would they destroy only until they had enough? Two rhetorical questions. And the answer, basically, is yes to both of those questions. If the great gatherers came, there'd be some left over. They wouldn't get every single grape on the vine. If you gleaned that vine, you'd find some. If thieves broke into your house at night, would you come back to an empty house? No, you'd come back to dresser drawers all over the place. They'd only take your diamonds that were in those dresser drawers, okay? Something would be left behind. And that's the point. And the point is a contrast. The contrast is brought out in verse 10. Grape gatherers are going to act one way. Thieves are going to act one way. But God is going to act in a different way. Verse 10. But, there's your contrasting word. But, I have stripped Esau bare. I have uncovered his hiding places, so that he shall not be able to conceal himself. His offspring have been destroyed along with his relatives and his neighbors, and he is no more. So the bottom of the page there, in contrast to the grape gatherers, in contrast to the thieves, God is going to totally destroy Edom. Nothing's going to be left. Nothing's going to be left. And that's the point of the comment at the top of page 513. He is not, emphasizes the totality of the destruction. No grapes, no possessions, nothing. Now this whole idea is repeated in Ezekiel 25, Ezekiel 35, and Obadiah, as you see there, points 1, 2, and 3. Let me give you two other cross-references that agree with this whole concept. Isaiah 34, verses 8 through 15. You'll see this again in Isaiah 34, verses 8 through 15. And you'll also see this in Joel 3:19. Joel 3:19. Since Joel 3:19 is a short verse, I put it up on the screen. Here's what you'd read if you get to Joel. Egypt will become a waste. And we know that Egypt will be desolated during the tribulation and remain a waste for the first 40 years of the Messianic kingdom. Egypt will become a waste. And Edom will become a desolate wilderness. Why? Because of the violence done to the sons of Judah, in whose land they have shed innocent blood. And so Joel agrees. And so this total destruction of Edom puts us in the tribulation. Ammon will be restored in the kingdom. But now in verses 7 through 22, we drop back to the time of Jacob's trouble. And we'll see, the reason we put this in the tribulation period is because this devastation has not occurred yet. Southern Jordan is not a desolate wasteland. Many people live there. You can go visit the city of Petra there. There's a lot of hotels there. Tourists go there all the time. It is not a desolate wilderness yet. And so it will come. This will occur in the tribulation period. And just to give you a hint of where it's going and beyond. Now, God is very merciful. We've seen that, very compassionate. And so he offers mercy in verse 11. Verse 11. He says, "Leave your orphans behind, and I will keep them alive. Let your widows trust in me." So if the men who are killed turn and place their trust in the Lord, they'll influence their families, even though they may be killed in the devastation. And point three is the idea here, that even if the fathers die in divine judgment, God offers the widows and the children life if they trust in God. And so he's offering salvation here. He's extending his hand in mercy. However, because the cup of wrath is going to be poured out on Edom, we find that this offer is rejected. The families want nothing to do with God. And so in verse 12, the cup of wrath is poured out on them. verse 12. For thus says the Lord, behold, those who were not sentenced to drink the cup will certainly drink it. Are you the one who will be completely acquitted? You will not be acquitted, but you will certainly drink it. So here's that indicator that the offer of acquittal, the offer not to be sentenced to drink the cup, is rejected. And so the Edomites will assuredly drink the cup of God's wrath. They will assuredly be punished. The offer of mercy is rejected. And point five is an important verse. Even if brother Jacob, who's part of the chosen people, is forced to drink the cup of God's wrath, so will his brother Esau. Jacob and Esau were brothers. So the wrath of God will fall on Israel during the tribulation period, but it will also fall on the Gentiles as well. The entire world will be affected by the wrath of God during the tribulation period. Whoa, boy, I'm done. I'm way early here. And question?
Do we have a minute for some Israel news?
Okay, I can give you some Israel news because I'm going to have to quit here. When we got to verse 13, we begin with the effect on Bozra. This is Bozra of the Edomites, Petra. Now, this is a very important section. We're going to review the campaign of Armageddon going through this section as well, so you'll see the importance of this. So, why don't we call it quits for right here? This is going to be a long and important and involved section. So, we'll call it quits. And you guys want some Israel news? Is that okay? We'll give you some Israel news here. Okay?